Okay, thank you very much. And I just want to check, can you hear me? Because of the mic. Okay, thank you. To add to the thank yous, first of all, and most importantly, I think for tonight, is thank you for coming. Thank you for coming out, for attending a talk by an artist you probably don't know so well. For sure, I haven't exhibited my work in Toronto, so thank you for trusting the press release, and I hope that it delivers in actual fact now what you expect, some of your expectations. But also thank you very much for Critical Distance, all the people that have helped me in the last day or so getting set up, and for welcoming me here to Toronto, and to Nevin and Annetta out there now, based in Ottawa, for inviting me, hosting me, and making this visit just extremely special and memorable. And I hope I can get to revisit, to come back at one point or more in the future. So thank you again. As Nevin mentioned, today I'm going to speak for a while, and then I'm going to talk to just a few works because I want to try and concentrate a little bit. And unlike a general artist talk, what we thought would be interesting is to use the perspective of the lens of time as a theme to try and address some of the questions of the work. So this is like the first time that I've done this, in terms of like going in at the work at a particular angle. So we'll see how that happens and how it breaks out. And in order to do that, I'm going to first set up a kind of set of axiomatics, a set of arguments and principles around the question of time and how it's mobilized some problems and propositions in my work. So I'll speak very generally at first, in a more philosophical or theoretical format, and then we'll move into kind of actually looking at artwork, right? So if you bear with me for this bit, what I'm going to do is set up some conditions and then we'll move on. Okay, so here we go. So the talk is called Constructing Time, as you know. And one of the first things I wanted to think about is, first of all, I think that all my work comes out of modality of like a kind of contemporary constructivist project. And I'm not referring to necessarily to constructivism here, although I am a big fan of constructivism, but I'm talking about the idea of a project that constructs. So that's something that's informed all my work for quite some time. But in terms of particularly this idea of time itself and what we might say about it, because we are dealing here with super abstract material, as I'm sure you know, one of the things we could say is that the labor of time, how we understand time in the world that we live in, is to construct meaning in the absence of time. And I'm going to talk about the real of time quite a lot in this opening section. So if it's not clear yet, I hope it will be in about 10 minutes. So one of the things we've got to be careful about whenever we talk about anything that we'd call the reality of or the real of, and the idea that time is something we construct, like it's a measure of our attitudes, our behaviors, the way we think about meaning. So history, for example, we have to be wary if we're going to say that if time is absence, if there is atemporality, if there is the atemporal, then we have to be wary of overdetermining the absence of time as a thing in itself. So it would become very contradictory and paradoxical to start labeling the idea of the absence of time with a thing, with an object or with a picture, and say that's what the absence of time is, because that would then be something in time, right? So how do we kind of think about the idea of the absence of time or the atemporal, because surely the atemporal is something beyond our ken, and it's also beyond our ability to sense it and to feel it empirically, emotionally, and what have you. And these kind of questions about time, but also about other realities or reals in the world have produced various problems in the history of art, but also the history of the political. And I'm just going to talk to a few of those for a minute because they support some of my responses that I've come up with in my practice. So one of the things that I grew up with, and I'm sure many of you lived through or grew up with too, is punk. And one of the things that punk was very famous for was to proclaim the kind of mantra and manifesto of no future. So punk shared this with post-structuralism. So many theorists and philosophers in post-structural theory shared this idea that the future has failed. The concept of the future is barred. And mainly that's because the hopes of the left up until 68 had been kind of aspirational, optimistic, and there was a sense of that there could be a political project. But with the failures of communism, the failures of left-wing uprisings in a global sense, 68 signaled this surrender to, let's call it, conservatism. And so there's a lot of narration in post-structuralism, and punk narrates this too, of a giving up on project, a giving up on the future. So time, the idea of time then becomes something that is cancelled as something that we would think of as playing a part in terms of being an agent of the future, of being able to predict and produce and commit to a future because the future was cancelled. But there's another kind of side to this, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the work of, say, Samuel Beckett or Bruce Nauman or artists that we consider doing, say, performance and time-based practices in, say, around the 1960s, 70s, and so on, where there's a lot of interest in this kind of idea of a tragic side of modernity, where the artwork would picture the limits of the human as infinite. So we're cursed to be in the present. So if you think about whether it's Nauman or Baldessari, and the kind of repeat, the repetitive gesture in an artwork, the kind of never-ending repeat, and this kind of having this tragic circumstance, this kind of entrapment in the present. So artists and, like I say, people like Samuel Beckett, and, you know, obviously we can think of Waiting for Godot, is this idea of conditioning ourselves to be ever-present. And we know it. So there's a kind of tragic recognition of being maintained in the present. So this kind of idea of the tragic modernity is also kind of conducive to maybe William Shakespeare's play Hamlet. And we get the idea of the conceptual being, right? So Hamlet, not the play, but the character, the Prince Hamlet, is the picture of the kind of modern intellectual. I'm sure if you've seen the play Hamlet or even the movie or whatever, you will know that Hamlet is the character who thinks. And because he's thinking, he cannot act. So the idea of conceptualizing and thinking prohibits the revenge of his murdered father, King Hamlet. So the kind of idea of a kind a knowing subject, someone who thinks and knows, curses you to inaction, to the incapacity to act upon your beliefs. It causes this circularity, this kind of entrapment. So I think there's this kind of tragic figure in modernity where thinking actually prohibits action. And of course, in punk, we get this idea of giving up on thinking itself, giving up on everything. So the intellectual was dead, and instead there was this kind of a form of nihilism that celebrated the, like I say, the cancelled future. But all the while, there's another narrative that kind of subtends these issues, and that's there's a general fear of the future as a totalitarian project. And the fear that thinking the future leads to a kind of cause and effect instrumentalism in the world. So what I mean by that is that after the Second World War and the horrors of Auschwitz, there was this decisionist sensibility to reject the idea of planning and predicting futures, because that was associated with the Enlightenment, with the dominant forms of reason, and the idea of an instrumentalism that would be seen to master and dominate the conditions of life, which would therefore exclude others. And I think that, you know, the whole work of Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer would speak to this really clearly, but many other authors and philosophers would speak to this problem. And so in the wake of the catastrophe of the horrors of the totalitarian project, what we see is, rather than the future as being a project, we see this idea of the future as open, an indeterminate space. And if you were to make artwork or literature that would claim the future as indeterminate and open, to live in uncertainty and indeterminacy, it would be seen to be a good, morally good kind of critical practice. So I think that these questions of a contemporary art that is in crisis, which is the tragic modern, it in the mode of resistance and refusal, which is the no to the future in punk, but also this idea of indeterminacy, which is this response to the totalitarian project, all picture the landscape of how we think about time and the political today. Whether we like it or not, I think we inherit that. So these are issues, basically, I hope that kind of makes sense, but these are issues that have supported my practice for a very long time, for many, many years. So my practice kind of is mobilized by these problems, because I think that these three readings of time and the future have misunderstood both time and how we act within it, and as part of conceiving of time itself. And so I'm just going to give another example of something that I've been looking at in my practice for quite a long time and writing about and thinking about, but I thought I'd put 24 up here also because it's got the Canadian relationship. but seriously, I do write about 24. So, but I wanted to kind of remind us of how drama operates in time and how drama requires different perceptions of time in order to be drama, i.e. when do we know something's dramatic? When do we know something has meaning? Well, it's often because times, different registers of time collide. And what we get in 24 is we see this clock that is counting down the episode. But often at moments of jeopardy or drama, what we see is another time, which is the time of the bomb ticking or another deadline within this landscape of time. So we get the time that is, let's call it natural, this idea of the time that counts, the time of the inevitable, like we're all getting older, whether we like it or not. We're all going, therefore, in a kind of straight line, in a fate, more like a fatalistic or telos of time. But at the same time, we get this idea of subjective perceived time, the being in the moment, the time of the bomb ticking, the time that counts. And these two times are often thrown together and collided to produce a sense of drama. And particularly in 24, that's how that operates. But it operates in all kinds of films as well, where we get a kind of subjectively perceived time laid up against this asymmetrical time of time's arrow, the time marching on, whether we like it or not. And often this asymmetrical time, this time that marches on, is seen to dispossess us of agency because we're up against time, right? And then there's time perceived through human experience where we're always inside time. So what that really means is that sometimes things can feel very long. If you're waiting for a bus or something and it's freezing cold, it might feel like you've been there forever. But also things can sense, you can sense that they're very short. So we have this kind of interaction between different levels of time. And I think 24 plays with more than that. But other films do too, and other forms of drama. But what is interesting to me is this kind of landscape of all the times that I've talked about, whether it's the indeterminate, the refusal, and so on, and including this one, they're all very interested in presentism, or being in the moment. So these formats of thinking time don't allow any questioning of the larger frameworks that subtend the reality in itself. So they do not really question the atemporal. And so I'm going to just talk about that for a moment. So the atemporal, something outside of time for us, brings me to a question of realism. And basically, realism, in the philosophical sense, is the idea of knowledge of a thing in itself without the concept of us having access to it. So this is basically to ask us to conceive of something that would be independent from the subject, and that this exteriority, this thing that's independent from us, must not be relativized to the subject. So this is the idea of thinking something beyond us, something that exists beyond us completely, without saying, well, it only exists beyond us because I thought it. So you can't relativize it back to yourself as the thing that it relies on to exist. So that's there's examples such as dinosaurs as existed before us, and we can prove that they did. So me saying that doesn't mean that I am related to the dinosaurs in a direct correlation. They existed in space and time as a fact before I did. And the world could be wiped out of humans but still continue. So the world doesn't rely on us to think it. The world exists independently, and so do other things. So we're not relativizing the thought of exteriority to ourselves who think it. And the problem of doing that is that we get this idea of a circle of self-reference. So everything comes back to the human who thinks it, this idea of that the world is for us. So what we also have is this concept that the absence of reason for any reality only reinforces this circle of solipsism. So if I could say, well, there's no reason for everything to exist. Science has yet not given us a reason why we're here, why the world exists. They might have said how we exist and how things have evolved, but there isn't as yet a reason that can think the cause of everything. So we don't have a sufficient reason to be. And so we lack that in the world. So the fact that we have no reason, there's an absence of reason for our reality, it often reinforces this idea that, well, all we've got is ourselves to explain ourselves. So we keep going around in circles. Every time I want to explain something, I'm using an example that is also a product of human construction, and that gets then regressively looped back. So we stay in these circles all the time. Every time we try and think of an outside, we get looped back in. You could say it's also analogous to how we often think about capitalism. A lot of people in the past have talked about escaping capital by being anti-capitalist, and therefore they produce certain forms of art or culture that they say is beyond art or beyond capital. And then they're very disappointed when that ends up being commodified or commercialized and looped back into the system. So this happens both at the level of capital, but also this solipsism, this coming back to the subject who makes things, is also a problem of trying to think about this idea of atemporality or the absence of reason of why anything should be. So it's really hard to be a nihilist, right? That's what this is. It's hard to be a nihilist because it's really hard to think about the absence of reason for why anything should be without making that absence a thing in itself? How do we take that absence seriously? So this leads to the problem of thinking atemporality in the political. So now I've got a quote here from this French philosopher called Quentin Meursault, who did a little paper called Time Without Becoming back in 2008. And he had an answer to this problem, of this solipsistic problem. And he said, a reality absolutely separate from the subject can be thought by the subject. So he invested this idea of our ability to conceive of a reality that is completely separate from us. Now that might sound kind of either super complex or super simple, it depends how you look at it. But the idea of thinking a reality that's absolutely separate from us is really interesting because we're thinking it, right? So we're thinking that reality, but we're thinking a reality that is without us. And somehow his ability to kind of formalize this in his theory allows us to step outside of that circle and not locate everything back to us. So even though I'm thinking about a reality in my own head, absolutely separate from me, it doesn't mean that that reality relies upon me to think it. It doesn't need me, even though I'm thinking it. So basically, that's the root of Meursault's kind of argument, which he would call a speculative materialism. So just to finish this, I'm going to talk really briefly about some ideas that relate to this question of realism. And what I wanted to do in my work was question the possibilities for art to propose and determine a future. I didn't want to say no to the future. I didn't want to give up on the future. I didn't want to make art that narrated its own failure to think a future. And I didn't want to assume that every idea of thinking a future would lead to the death camps. So I wanted to kind of go against all of the things that I was outlining at the beginning. And to really take that seriously, that commitment to a future. So I wanted to find out how commitments in the present are made in the production of ideas and images and artworks, and how they extend and infer commitments in time to a future. I wanted to think about how to explicate reality, we need to navigate the space of reasons and the space of causes with our language. So when I think about the space of reasons, I'm referring to this term. I've put some kind of people in who I kind of use to help me think about this. So Robert Brandom, American philosopher at Pittsburgh, writes a lot about the space of reasons and the space of causes. And what he's talking about there is that the space of reasons is a space, a public space of discursive operations where we address each other as people who not only use reason but bring that into the public sphere and we discuss. So it's a discursive space where we're thinking about, we're making cases for why we think things. We're explicating our own reasons all the time, whether we kind of know it or not. So what's important is that reason, just like when I was talking about reality, has no cause. It's the same kind of problem. There's no cause for reason. We, as a species, reason, and that's what defines us, often against other beings, other animals and creatures, because we can self-conceive, we're self-aware. So that's kind of what he refers to as the space of reasons. And the space of causes, he's referring to the space of like empirical cause and effect. So where we can understand what caused something. So if I push, knock the water over, I understand that I caused it. So I know the cause. So it's a space of causes which happens in empirical kind of lived experience. And also, we have another distinction between the scientific and the manifest image. And this is a term that I'm taking from Wilfred Sellers, predominantly another American philosopher who Branham actually writes about a lot. And what we have in Sellers' work is an interesting distinction between the manifest image, which he refers to as the God-given, the kind of world we take to be natural, and we don't kind of question what is manifest, and the idea of the scientific image, which is an image that has reasoned out the conditions of its existence. Now, Sellers produces this stereoscopic view across the two, because often what is the manifest image at one point would have been the scientific image. So we can say, make claims about the facts of the world and observations, and which seem to be new to us and change our mind about how things work. Like, are we a planet that rotates around the sun, or does the sun rotate around us, for example? So the Copernican revolution is kind of crucial to one of these shifts in the scientific image to the manifest image. But if we were to discover something else after that, then that scientific image of our cosmology might change, might be seen as then the manifest image, something natural and received wisdom. So they're kind of relations that come in and out of view. They have a mutual non-fixity. But both these philosophers kind of separate out the world, but also ask us to make a bridge between these different spaces. And I think that's really interesting and helpful for me to try and navigate not just this idea of time, but also reality and the image of it. One last thinker that I'm very interested in is, he's called David Lewis, another American thinker. So he would write a lot about time travel and the ability to time travel in one dimensionality. So he talked about lots of theories of the multiverse, but also writes very interestingly on literature. So when you read a fiction, of course, you've got time's arrow, you're going in one direction. But he talked about how even in one-dimensional literary narrative or in film narrative, it is possible to time travel in that space by making loops and returns and ellipses in time. So I'm not going to go into that much because it's quite complex, but it's something that's very much been interesting to my practice. So in all of this, what all these theories kind of deliver for me is this idea of a kind of transcendental subject position that can take this perspective of non-time. So what I mean by that is, remember when Quentin Meyersault, just in the last slide, talks about a reality separate from the subject can be thought by the subject. So that would be a kind of thinking of what is the non-time of the subject from my subjectivity. And I believe it can be done. It also means that the transcendental subject, the subject who pulls out from the world a bit and looks at it, can kind of think about this stereoscopic view, this stereoscopic view between the space of reasons and the space of causes, the spaces where we haven't got explanations for things and the space where we have explanations for things, and how those registers of the things that seem irreducible to explanation and the things that are reducible to explanation kind of meet, and we can kind of navigate over the two. So this question of time also becomes a question of the image, the question of representation, but also the question of space. So I've got one last little quote from Quentin Meyersault, and it says, "Everything is contingent except contingency itself." So the very idea that everything being contingent means that anything could happen at any point. An elephant could walk in this room right now. That could happen. It probably won't, but it could. So the idea of contingency allows for this sense of indeterminacy in the world. But because contingency itself is not contingent, and contingency is absolute in Quentin Meyerso's work, what we have is this idea that it's not that anything can happen, but it's just as likely that everything can stay the same. So the two ideas, contingency doesn't mean that everything's unstable all the time. That's actually quite a stable motif. So if I say everything's always already changing, then I'm kind of saying, well, I know for a fact that everything's always already changing. So that's not contingency. That's just me knowing that everything changes all the time. Whereas he absolutizes contingency to make a radical hyper-contingency, a hyper-chaos, where contingency itself means that everything could just stay the same. As much as it's open to change, it could just open to stability as well. It's such a radical sense of non-fixity. And that's where we get a kind of theory of nihilism proper in this work. It's radically contingent. So I hope that makes sense. It's quite complicated, but it's important because a lot of these theories of the open artwork and indeterminacy that art had been very embracing of post-68, actually, art's love affair with contingency and the indeterminate and the open and the ineffable and the unknowable was actually very sure about those things. They were very stable concepts. We can be certain that we're uncertain. We can be sure that things are indeterminate. So actually, it's contradictory. So the investment in the idea of indeterminacy was a contradiction and actually quite conservative. So how do we take that seriously? Well, we think, well, the world is just as likely to be stable as it is to be unstable. That is to think from nihilism, to think from the atemporal and the non, to think from the negative, and to think from the absence of time. And this is the project that I've been involved with for a long, long time, but also the project, obviously, with a lot of philosophers who've been doing this for many more years than me. But basically, that has informed most of my practice, well, kind of all my practice for ages. So now I'm going to talk about some artwork in particular. And hopefully some of those ideas, I'm not going to speak to those ideas really directly again, but hopefully some of those ideas you'll maybe see manifest in different ways in these works. I'm going to talk really briefly about this work called Final Machine. This is the first poster advertising the show. It was produced originally for Lanchester Gallery Projects in the UK quite a few years ago now. It's a 45-minute work, and it has three screens. These are two of the screens. This was also shown at the MAC in Montreal, in the Montreal Biennial, curated by Peggy Gale and Gregory Burke in 2014. And this was the installation in Montreal. So you can see that there's a carpet, there's a circular bench, and there's two screens there, and there would be one screen here. So it's like a triangular shape. And you start off watching the red screen, and then you move to the yellow one that had a yellow circle, and then there's a green circle here. So it's like traffic lights. It's super simple system of where you start and move around or turn around the space. The work was installed on these quite large slabs that looked like concrete kind of edifices. And when you look at them from one side, they look very much like minimalist sculpture, like kind of land art from the ilk of like Tony Smith or Donald Judd and so on. So this idea of literalism and minimalism has been really key to my practice for many years as well, in the idea of like being literal. Like how does that kind of operate as a force in language? And then also, I wanted to kind of think about this more like pop aesthetic and the graphic aesthetic of a pop culture language. So not just pop art, but pop culture. And the idea of the music video or the trailer as being key to, again, a lot of my work, because I'm really interested in how the intro sequences to movies condense films in very abstract ways with image, story, and graphics, but they don't really have a narrative that would make sense, but somehow they collapse the film into a 2-minute sequence that gives you that film. So even though this work is quite long at 45 minutes, it still has that sense of compression of data. So the carpet on the floor has cutouts with circles. And you'll see that, we did a book as well, which is outside, with some authors writing essays that are not really about the work, but kind of in parallel with the work. So I'm going to show you a few clips of this. I never would really want to screen this as a single channel piece because it's meant as an installation. It was built like that. I'm going to show you a few little clips of it and we'll see how that goes. But I think that one thing just to say is that the motif of the circle and the idea of a circular kind of loop is something that's really crucial to this work. Circles are everywhere in this piece, and it really directly speaks to that problem or the kind of ways in which that solipsism works in our incapacity to think the real, and how the thinking of the real, the thinking of an outside, often draws us back into a circular, self-referential problem. So this question of thinking the real subtended all of the work. The other aspects of this that kind of inform the work are just like I talked about the space of cause, where we think of what one thing causing another in a cause and effect relation. And that's how we kind of understand the world, often in a kind of very straight linear empirical sense. One of the things that really influenced this work was a series of lectures that Louis Althusser gave in 1968 in the University of Nanterre in Paris. And these lectures were called Spontaneous Philosophy of the Scientists. So what happened in those lectures was he said, I'm going to give some lectures and they're for scientists, not for artists, not for philosophers, but for scientists. So he had scientists come to his lectures and he basically talked to them about their spontaneous philosophy. And what he means by that is that the way in which science itself spontaneously believed in itself. And once it had achieved a kind of claim that was based on logic, facts, or whatnot, it would then rely on that and not question it again and not be vigilant. It would just believe in it and become kind of like almost a theological idea of science. And Althusser was arguing that in order to be good scientists, you needed philosophers to help you be vigilant. So it was kind of interesting. But what I found fascinating, not just the content of the lectures, also their mode of delivery, which is extremely rhetorical and persuasive and has its own poetics, but also there was a myth around these lectures. And the myth was that every week they were going on, more and more people arrived and they were getting really packed out, to the point that the last one they had to cancel because of the crowds. And then, poof, 68 happens. So there's an infamous kind of mythology around these lectures that they were one of the key catalysts of the actual 68 student uprising. Whether you believe that or not, that's another thing. But the very idea that a series of lectures on science would produce political, like real physical action in the world, that was really interesting to me, especially when Althusser was often called out by the Communist Party for not marching, for not protesting, and for not being at the barricades. So that the idea of how philosophy as thought material has an actual, empirical, demonstrable impact, instrumentalist kind of impact in the social, and that how it has this myth around it in this instance is really amazing. So I built this pseudo-lecture that constitutes the work. So there is a voiceover, and it has a kind of lecturing, didactic, dogmatic voice. The other thing that influenced the work, and I'm sure you've seen it, is the very famous documentary called The Fog of War, where there's Robert McNamara is talking about the use of force and the CIA special ops and so on. So what I did was I kind of wrote a script that mashed up my sensibilities and thoughts around the fog of war, but also Althusser's lectures. And it ended up in something that if you were to watch it, you probably wouldn't recognize either of those references. So it became a thing in itself. But that's really where the work comes from. So I've talked enough. So we can maybe find... I'm going to show you like little excerpts from it. Let me see. Okay, it's actually up here. Okay.
And we can incorporate them into this play. The myth that seeing can tell us anything about reality.
Okay, so I'll do one more little clip. This is section 3. Okay. I should just say that at the beginning of sections 2 and 3, we have these, like, obviously cause and effect kind of sentences which goes, switch the light on, switch the light goes off, because often in, like, I was just using the most banal and obvious cause and effect kind of functionalist narrative, in the sense that that's something we all know, and how we expect the world to work, right? Because the way we interact with our surroundings gives us a kind of map and a gesture for how we expect everything else to work for us. And often when we turn the light on and it doesn't come on, we're like, or deeply frustrated, or like angry. So it's interesting to think of how we construct a world around us that is reliant upon function, you know, cause and effect functions. And when we come up against, when we do not have reasons for why things are, we often get thrown into these kind of other zones. And of course, the whole piece is about like navigating the causal and those zones together, and using this kind of narrative of people who actually not only master reality, but also intervene in causal reality, such as special ops, crime syndicates, and CIA kind of operatives, but also philosophers at the same do this too. It kind of sets up this kind of fiction of this kind of subterranean or criminal activity that navigates the real. So let's just look at a little bit more.
What we're seeing is real. April 10th through April 20th, in a state near you, this has been repeated. SWAT teams, civilian police SWAT teams across states and counties, violating every canon of a free society. Police, state, civilians, county, city, you name it. For any reason at all, call the military 24 hours a day for assistance. That's the invitation. Please do not hesitate. Do not feel that we are a last resort asset. We're here to support you 24 hours a day. We need to get...
Okay. So, I'm gonna, if I can find my cursor, there we go. Just bear with me for 1 minute. Okay, so I'm gonna now, and of course, if anyone has more questions and needs to ask things about this, I'm absolutely happy to discuss it after or with drinks. I'm gonna talk about one more piece just very quickly, and then we'll show that. And this is a piece called Covenant Transport, Move or Die. And it was filmed and scripted, produced between 2013 and 2015. And it's a 5-channel video installation. This is a still from it. It featured 4 actors. And it was filmed in Marfa in Texas and in Los Angeles, and also in other parts of the desert. Oh, and in radios as well, in Pesos. So it's hard to show you the work because it's, again, an installation. I'm going to show you the main screen. There's a large main screen. I'll show you a picture of it. This was when it was shown at the Beirut City Forum in 2015. And then this is when it was installed at the Baltic in the UK more recently, this is the entranceway to the show. And then there was a room inside with 2D works, because I also make 2D works, which I'm not speaking about much today, obviously. And then when you walk through that room, you get to this room with the video installation. So this is probably an easier slide to see of it. There's a big main screen there, 4 smaller screens there that go at different angles, an angular bench, and the usual carpeted room to help with the sound. So the work, as it might suggest, it's called Covenant Transport, Move or Die. And so the very idea of a covenant is something like a contract. It's something we're all kind of signed to. And a covenant usually refers to a pre-political contract, i.e. something we signed before we even get here. So a kind of, before you even like arrive on the planet as a human being, you've already, you're in the covenant to transport. And that idea of the contract to a universal contract to mobility and the ideologies of being mobile were really important in this piece. So the work filmed literally many trucks, many trains. And if you're ever out in Texas, and there's not much out there apart from train tracks and haulage trains going through the terrain, and I spent a lot of time filming them. I also filmed on the roads. And so the work, again, was pretty literal in terms of dealing with the subject matter. But what I wanted to think about was the way being plastic, flexible, fluid, all these words we could use, nimble, mobile, were all seen as not only good things to be desired, but they were necessary things to survive in the condition of contemporary neoliberal capital. They're also things that have been praised to be by artists. So if your work is somehow flexible or speaks to its indeterminacy, again, as I mentioned earlier, it was seen to be kind of more critical. I'll give you a really basic example of that in a very literal sense. So when people started to make video very early on, like in the history of art, a lot of the politics that were claimed around that wasn't really, they could talk about the work itself and the content of the work, which is all interesting, but there was a claim made for the medium itself. The claim made for the medium of video was that it was, it could be shown anywhere, it was kind of ephemeral, you could show video at any scale, therefore it seemed to be its immateriality seemed to contest the representational stability of painting, for example. So if you were a video artist, you were kind of seen to be more political and more critical than if you were painting or doing sculpture. So these are really old ideas that I don't think many people are talking about now, but it's still interesting to me that people would argue that about video, and especially in a world where most video artists, including myself, are hyper obsessive about the architecture of the video medium and how specific it is to sight, and how lots of my installations are very needy. They need tech and they need people building things. So my work isn't that video that can kind of go anywhere and be anything. In fact, I'm super interested in the architectural format of video and the materiality of the immaterial, which kind of goes back to that Althusserian question of the materiality of thought. So I wanted to think about this in the work, and how, again, that how stability plays a part in these systems, like what is consistent in the ideology of mobility, and also how, yeah, these ideas of art as ephemeral, ineffable, occupying the place, the way arts claim to occupy the place of unfixity, were kind of dreams for art. So I made this kind of video with these four characters, and the characters, this is perhaps where a bit more narrative on time kind of comes into it, because these characters, just like kind of in my voiceover and the positions in the last work, they have this kind of affordance of a transcendental view. Nevertheless, they live in the world. They're part of the world and they're caught in the twists and turns of it. So they're not living on Mount Olympus looking down, but they somehow have managed to understand reality in its complexity. The characters themselves, I say characters, I shouldn't really say that, because they don't really have personalities. They were scripted for anyone to say, and when we did workshops with the actors played each other as characters for ages, and it was only later when actors would say, I really want this one, that we would decide. So it wasn't cast in a character way, they're more like avatars speaking manifesto-like propaganda throughout, from the position of this view of reality is outside from within the conditions of its life, of a life in the world. One of the things that I did also in the work was I decided that the characters would be dressed in a kind of pre-89 aesthetic. Yeah, obviously the work is made now, it says it is, it's contemporary, and these people are quite young. So these people are wearing band t-shirts from albums that were produced, released before 89. And what I was thinking of with that kind of play on time or time in the work that doesn't kind of make sense is that this was a kind of time that I'd consider to be before irony really took hold in the world, before hipsters and so on were really around. So when you wore a band t-shirt back then, it meant that you liked the band, okay? And that was really obvious. Whereas nowadays, as we know, that you can walk into a place and see someone with a band t-shirt on, and as I made the mistake of doing this, literally, I'll tell you a true story. I was in a donut shop in LA, and I walked in and I heard this song, and it was by a band that I used to really like called Stiff Little Fingers, and it was Inflammable Material, like the title song of the album, and I was like, oh, Stiff Little Fingers. I turned around to buy the donut, and the girl's wearing a Stiff Little Fingers sweatshirt, and I'm like, oh, isn't that strange? You're playing Stiff Little Fingers, you're wearing a Stiff Little Fingers sweatshirt, isn't that amazing? And she's like, what? And I'm like, you know, because you've got the Stiff Little Fingers top on. She's like, So she didn't know who they were, and I was like, oh God, I'm so embarrassed, forget about it, I'm sorry. But that kind of thing happens to me quite a lot. And maybe it does to you, where you take something seriously between what is written and what is meant. But of course, irony plays a massive part in our culture today. And I was thinking about what happens again, this like literalist approach. What if we mean it? What if it was meant? And what happens in that world where we mean what we say? Let's fantasize about that for a moment. And also we can communicate with each other in that way. So the idea of this work in all its complexity and strange meanderings actually does try and think about that kind of question of a subjectivity that speaks, let's say. So I'm going to stop talking there. This work's about 17 minutes long. I'm just going to set it going. As I say, it's the main screen. I'm not going to show you the side screen because it wouldn't make sense. I can roughly show you like 10 seconds of it just to give you a little clue, like, but this hasn't got sound attached to it in this video, so we can just see like 10 seconds, but this is like a kind of graphic LED cheap advertising sloganeering screen that kind of purposely distracts you from the main screen, and they kind of have a sync element all the way through. By the way, the work isn't looped. None of the works that I've shown you are looped. They kind of have a beginning and an end, even if they're not kind of, they don't have a narrative arc. Okay, so that gives you an idea of what's going on there. And then we can move to showing this work.
Cognizant of a fact, I showed it, I proved it, it functions.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much.
So we're running a bit behind, but there's maybe a couple questions.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a role for space or stillness or silence in your works in relation to your ideas about time.
The answer is really, in a really like blunt way, no. and I mean that as a positive kind of response because one of the things that again, I've been really motivated by in the work is it is this relation of image force image and how that kind of manifests. And I'm kind of thinking a lot in the work about how the works push people, like push the audience. And I don't mean in the sense that like you go in and you learn something and then you leave and you go, okay, well, now I know this, you know. So they're not revelatory in any way they're not allegorical, but they are very demanding. And in that sense, they do not kind of speak to an audience with care. And I think it's interesting to think about how an artwork might operate that does not need an audience, that is not the kind of dialogical mode of listen to me, now I'm going to give you this time or space to think, and then I'm going to, you know, operate like this. And, you know, of course, many artworks all operate differently, but in my interests, I wanted to think about the kind of hubris almost of an autonomous work. What is autonomy in the work itself? What world does the work produce in its own right? And what is it like for us to meet it and have to deal with it? And that might not be desired or wanted. People might look at it for 10 seconds and go, okay, I'm going, you know? But what is it to kind of meet the conditions of perhaps what could be called or seen to be a language that one has to learn, or a vernacular that one has to get used to and give that time? And, you know, somebody did once say to me years ago, like about 11 years ago, when they saw a piece, that it was like meeting a set of people who spoke a different language, like the one they'd never heard before, and they had to deal with that and try and get to know it. And that sounds kind of really scary and difficult, but that's kind of, I remember that response because I was really happy about that. And I like the idea that works are demanding. And I think, I'm not saying that works with silence aren't demanding. I'm not trying to just say that I'm not being so crude about that. But I think part of the way in which I construct that is through its insistence and constant pressing and the sense of that it kind of gives you the sense sometimes, I don't know about these works, but certainly in past ones, that you're left behind. So in the lecture format work, the voiceover does say, you remember when I told you something earlier? It refers to an earlier point in knowledge. It says, by now you should know this because I've told you already. So it refers to a past in the work, but the past actually never happened. So it purposely treats you like you should have known something already. And that's a kind of, again, a really manipulating rhetorical kind of advance it's making to kind of dispossess us a little bit. And also when any work operates often with text or with that kind of lecture format, we're trained to think, well, I should be listening, you know, I should be reading or I should be listening. And I'm interested in how our own kind of ideological kind of premises produce us as like good viewers, and how we feel about that. Like, I mean that when, like I was talking about the light switch, when things kind of, when we're not in catching up with the world, where it puts us a bit. So I think that, yeah, the work is invested in that kind of intensity, I guess, and like what can be played out in that territory. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and music obviously is super important. And when I make the work, I take everything into account at the same time. So it's not like I'll predominantly think of script and acting, or predominantly think of imagery and then add on music at the end. You know, music is often the first thing I think about. So in particular with the last piece, I wrote lyrics for a song and asked two bands to record it without talking to each other. And I knew what each band kind of did, or was like their kind of ideas and about their music. So I knew what I was kind of going to get, in the sense that we know what bands do, and but I didn't know exactly what they were going to do. So I was really interested in this kind of duplication and mirroring, but it's almost like they're doing, one's doing a cover of the other or something. If you really listened, you'd see that they're saying the same thing, but they're not a cover. Not one didn't come after anyone. They're simultaneous, produced at the same time. And I guess for me, those kind of secrets of the work are really what I was playing with, but also in terms of other sound effects in that piece that were very much about simultaneity. And therefore, they really problematize that idea of cause and effect, like linear. So there's a lot of things in that work that really try and disrupt that speak to a cause and effect narrative, of course, because that's what we're watching, a linear narrative, but they don't disrupt the cause and effect narrative, the line, by doing a kind of typical postmodern, well, here's lots of fragments, and, you know, that's a really standard postmodern approach in the 80s to kind of constructing video or painting or whatever, which is, here's lots of fragments, I'll put them in a collage, and then there's a frame for the work. So it's not about the fragment, but it is about these attempts to collide things in certain simultaneities. And so the music was like my pleasure to kind of think about that. And in fact, it's a project I'm working on now, actually, with music to kind of do that as well. So that became really important from this piece, and I felt it wasn't resolved as well as it could be, or it became a facet of the piece that's more hidden. And so it led to the production, this piece I'm doing now, which is very much about like putting that as a primary focus. So I guess that's how that helps me think about the atemporal as a kind of the fictive atemporal, because of course the atemporal, as I was saying, is just a concept. You know, what is it to model it, and how do we model these things that we can't really manifest, but we can produce in fictional constructions? And these fictional constructions can have great impact in the world, you know. So, and I mean that not just in the sciences, but also in the arts. Yeah.
In this last piece, the words that you have these actors saying are difficult, but they actually come across pretty well. You had a large rehearsal time.
Oh, yeah.
And they did each other's lines.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was quite impressive, just that they could get through this.
I know.
Verbiage, and it actually feels like they know what they're talking about.
Well, that's good. we did rehearse for a long time. Thankfully, I also had, as you see in the credits, I had a performance coach working with them all the way. We did all kinds of stuff that I've never seen. I'm not an actor, I don't train actors myself, you know, so I was very happy to call upon people who knew how to get performances out of people. And also the actors, some of them were really interested in the ideas. They read literature and philosophy, and there's kind of like references to other forms of literature in the text, and some of them really knew what they were, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. So there's some real references to Kafka and being stuck in systems and never getting out, and and one of them came up to me and said, isn't this like around what Kafka would say? And I was like, yes, totally what Kafka would say. So it was fascinating to work with them, not just in their skills and their training, but also their like real commitment to kind of understanding, feeling what the words might mean, and finding their own expression for them. So yeah, they did a lot of work, and it was very hot as well on the day we were filming. So they did fantastically well.